Grab your spot here and get ready to talk about Bond, James Bond, on We Got the Geek.
All right, everybody, welcome to another explosive-filled episode of Shaken, Not Stirred, our continuing look at all of the James Bond movies. This week, I'm joined in the studio by our very own agents of Spectre, John Blofeld Balmer and Remington Hunter.
Nice.
Hey, guys.
Yes, Hunter. I like this. I'm okay with being a con man pretending to be somebody better than he is.
So, I'm Blofeld. Yeah, I'm the jerk.
Well, hey, they did get the rights back to him.
Wait, so. which actor, though?
Oh, the cool Donald Pleasant.
Okay.
I was
going to say, the guy with the scar on his...
If you were going to make me Telly Savalas Blofeld, I was going to punch you.
Kojak.
Oh, man.
Kojak Balmer.
Cut off my earlobes just to be a different actor, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Hey, wasn't he the one from the Lazenby one, though?
Yes.
So you killed James Bond's wife, if that's you.
Good on ya.
Well, it's Diana Rigg, right? She's hot, but she's old now, so it's okay.
Yeah. All right. So the boys are going to be joining me here tonight to talk about the first Pierce Brosnan James Bond movies, GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies. Mm-hmm. So let's take us back to 1995 when GoldenEye came out. It had been 6 years since the last Bond movie.
Yep.
Lots of legal issues had been pressed.
Particularly because Dalton was supposed to be, I think, signed on for like 3 more movies.
Yep. And they approached him at first and he said no. Because it had been a while when they by the time they got around to doing it again. So this was the longest wait between Bond movies to date as well, 6 years. So I want to ask you guys, were you guys seeing the movies in the theater back then, and did that wait piss you guys off?
The wait bothered me because, like, we remember, I got into Bond with A View to a Kill back in, what, 85, 86?
Yeah.
84.
Or somewhere around there.
84. Because,
but it was not I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it when it was on.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service is 86. And then...
On Her Majesty's...
Oh, no, the first Timothy Dalton one is 86, and then it was...
The Living Daylights.
The Living Daylights, yeah. And then License to Kill was 89.
So it was 85 or 86 when I finally got to see A View to a Kill on First Choice Super Channel back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
So I saw that, and then I saw The Living Daylights, License to Kill, and then I went back and saw everything before that.
Well, you had some time there, I guess.
Yeah. So I didn't realize that there was such a big gap because I was getting caught up on all of the James Bond continuity. And then that put me into high school, you know, through the early 90s there. So it was only a year or two between me getting caught up with Fresh Bond before the Pierce Brosnan one came out. So I didn't realize there was that much of a gap, but I was excited because it was a new Bond. And, you know, I had understood that there was a gap, but not really for me, because I'd kind of gotten caught up on all of the world of Bond before that. So it didn't really hit me as hard as it hit a lot of other fans, but...
Yeah, because before then, it was like maybe 2 to 3 years between each
movie. 2 to 3 years tops in between each one, yeah.
No, GoldenEye was the first Bond movie I saw in the theater.
Oh, okay.
So I had no, like, precedent of wait time. It was just, oh, okay, there's a new James Bond... new actor, and my mom's like, all right, we're going to see the movie. Because she had been introducing me to random ones. Like, I mean, I think the first one that I saw was Live and Let Die, and then, like, Goldfinger, and eventually, like, she'd buy me the VHSs of, like, Dr. No and that. And so I had gotten them all over the place. But this was the first one that we'd gone to the theaters for, and it was great. Like, I loved it, because it was the first chance to see, like, this... character on the big screen for me. So
we were lucky neither one of us had to suffer through the wait.
Yeah.
And I was stoked. I didn't get to see GoldenEye in the theater. I saw it a year later when I could get the VHS and grabbed that up and was just excited. Like, so, yeah, it came out when I was in the 11th grade.
Oh, okay.
And I watched it, the start or middle of 12th grade, something like that.
Yeah, like the gap was shorter, but it felt longer for me going from the last Brosnan one to the first Daniel Craig one.
That's,
just because...
Yeah, that's what seemed like a long time for me.
Because that was me watching each one in the theater every few years, and now we had the gap from, like, what was it, like, 2003 or 2000?
Well, the last Brosnan came out in 2002.
2002, and then it was, like, 2006 for Casino Royale.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Because, yeah, it was like 2006, 2008, and then 2012.
Well, I'm going to ask Hunter this, because John and I recently reviewed the Timothy Dalton movies. What were your thoughts on those two?
I don't actually mind Timothy Dalton. I think I look back more fondly at it than him actually being good in those movies. Because now I've seen him in so many other things that I've liked him in, that now I can go watch him in the Bond movies and go, oh, yeah, it's Timothy Dalton. Like,
yeah. I don't know. I like him in just about everything that he's in. Like, I really enjoyed his character in Flash Gordon, and I really enjoyed him in The Rocketeer as the villain.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, I liked him on Chuck. I liked him.
He was an awesome Bond. I really enjoyed how gritty he was compared to what we had before.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you go from, like, a 60-year-old Roger Moore to... Yeah, I know. Fuck Roger Moore. to a young Timothy Dalton, and it's just like, oh, wow, James Bond can actually run across the room without needing to stop and take a minute.
Well, we had one good Roger Moore movie. Well, two.
I like two.
Live and Let Die and The Man with the Golden Gun were really his best, and then I enjoy the rest of his run just because they were fun movies, even though he was ancient.
And it's funny you bring that up, because I was just reading, I was doing a little research about Brosnan as Bond, and I guess by the time they got to 2002, they wanted him out of there because they felt he was too old,
yeah.
But he was only 49 at the time.
Yeah, and he actually, the first one was awesome. He was a great Bond to start out with GoldenEye. As it progressed, it kind of ups and downs, but I don't think it's entirely his fault. I really enjoyed Brosnan's Bond, and GoldenEye was something exciting for me when that was released.
Well, that's how I feel about Roger Moore. Like, it wasn't his fault, the ones I didn't like. Like, he was the best.
Some of them are just a terrible premise, or, like, just really bad villains, or, like...
Or a blimp sneaking up on a 90-year-old man and View to a Kill.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... There was just a lot of either script or directing issues that really came about. You know, you got to remember some of these actors are just kind of doing what they're told for the most part.
Yeah.
And the same thing, like, with the Brosnan ones, as they got on, I felt like a lot of it was just them trying to go special effects.
Yep.
Like, I felt like the movie suffered because you'd try and have these elaborate effect sequences that they weren't really putting a lot of money into that look really, like, bad special effects ones. Like, you'll get to the last one and the parasailing. All I'm going to say.
I have a lot to say about that last one. Like, out of his four, I felt he did two good ones and two crap ones. And I think it really comes down to the direction of them. So the first and third were my favorite Brosnan ones.
Hmm.
The second and fourth were garbage.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you when we get into the second review.
Okay.
But we'll get to that shortly. So, Dalton was out. Brosnan was in. He'd actually been screwed out of the role back in 1986.
Because of Remington Steele.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because I think, you know, I'm glad we got Dalton.
I want to see the parallel universe where it's Pierce Brosnan in License to Kill. Living Let Die. Because he was supposed to be before Roger Moore.
Oh, that's
great. That's right, yeah.
He was supposed to be before Roger Moore. So I want to see, like,
I would love to see
Pierce Brosnan as James Bond in Moonraker. Like,
I think if we would have got him when he was younger, I think we would have gotten a more edgy version than we got out of Brosnan.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm really satisfied with where we got him. You know,
he came in at a right time to revitalize the franchise, because License to Kill did very, very poorly.
Which is a shame, because
GoldenEye did exceptionally well.
Yeah, and I still watch that one a lot. I really do enjoy
GoldenEye. Well, I have fond memories of it, too, because I was at the age where I just started playing a lot of video games with my friends, and the GoldenEye video game.
N64. I was going to ask you guys, because everyone I talked to about the movie had their memories were... they had more fond memories of the game than they did the movie.
Yeah, well, the game was, like, one of the first really defining multiplayer shooting games, where you have four guys around a TV all trying to kill each other. And it even brought back, like...
Odd Job.
Like, it brought back Odd Job, Mayday, Baron Samedi.
Oh,
wow. Like, there's a Moonraker mission in it, which is a fantastic mission. Like...
Yeah, it was really a fun game, and it was that game that got... Like, multiplayer didn't exist online then. So
and it was just barely on computers. Like, you had some games like Doom and like Wolfenstein that are doing it a little bit, or like going that way. This was the first one that people really got, like,
and you could really get going on it, because you get four guys around the one console, and you know you're pushing your guy, your buddy, next to you. You're pushing him off the couch so that you can shoot him as you sneak up on him, because you look at each other's screens to see where they are. Right?
Oh yeah.
It was great. It made for a lot
and it was made like the last couple weeks, like right before it went out. There was originally not going to be a multiplayer mode. They didn't get approval from Nintendo for it. They just went, yeah, we're just going to throw it in. It's just going to be like this extra thing. Here's a bunch of fun old Bond characters.
Yeah, it was really great. And it really was, that was what got people like me hooked on multiplayer games once we did get them with like the PlayStation 2, when we finally had multiplayer options on like SOCOM and things like that. And now with Call of Duty on, you know, the current systems. I'm hooked on multiplayer. I don't even play campaigns anymore, and it was because I got hooked on playing against other people, where it would be more unpredictable than a computerized game or a campaign. You had the unpredictability of having three other guys that are doing something completely different from you. And GoldenEye was what got me stuck on it.
And the funny thing was, it led into Pierce Brosnan and Judi Dench doing the voices in one of the next Bond games, like a couple years down the road.
Oh, cool.
They did a Bond game, and Pierce Brosnan and Judi Dench both did the voices for it. Yeah. So that was neat.
I even have the last Bond game that came out for PS3 with the PlayStation Move, where I can actually use the big rifle.
Oh,
And the multiplayer in that's a little bit slow, but it's still fun. It's just cool to be Bond and walking through the world shooting things. But yeah, GoldenEye it was on the N64 only.
Even the late, yeah.
And, oh, so much fun. If I could get my hands
on it. It's on the Wii now. Because they made a version, like, they updated it and put it back on the Wii. And Bomer's just gone silent. Yeah,
I have a Wii.
Yeah.
I don't have an N64 anymore. I'm going to go find GoldenEye now.
There you go, man.
Right on.
Oh, I know what I'm doing that tomorrow. I'm going to go find a copy. You bastard.
Yeah.
I'm going to get my son job. Playing GoldenEye on a Wii now.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's my job.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, I love you, too.
All right, so before we hit the first break, so Brosnan got the role, but they'd actually considered three other guys, and I'll get your opinions on this. Liam Neeson, Hugh Grant, and Mel Gibson.
My opinions?
So Qui-Gon, Riggs, and romantic comedy guy.
I could have seen Liam Neeson do it. Like, you've now seen Liam Neeson do Taken?
Yeah.
To know that he could do that secret agent-y kind of, like, dark?
Yeah, Liam Neeson, I could see doing it. I don't know what kind of longevity he would have had as Bond, but I certainly think he could have pulled off one or two really well. Mel Gibson, that's just stupidity. That's all that is just even... It's stupidity to think that.
The only thing I can think of when I think of Mel Gibson doing that is him slapping his face as Riggs in Lethal Weapon, going like, yep, that's the smooth, debonair class of a James Bond right there. Like, even when he's played like that smooth, trying to play that smooth ladies' man kind of figure, he just comes off as a creep as opposed to actually smooth. So,
and who was the other one?
Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant, I would say probably not. I don't think we could have gotten a tough version of him.
Well, he's too busy picking up hookers, I guess.
Yeah. My pick, to be honest with you, like, I would love... It's too late now, but I would have loved to see Clive Owen, maybe back then, picked as a Bond option. Because I think he could have done a really good Bond.
Yeah, I can see that.
But sadly, again, you know, all these great actors that we would get a great option out of, just... They're old now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't want to repeat the Roger Moore thing, I guess.
Well, it's because, like, right now, like, I'm trying to think of other British action stars that you could see taking over the role from Craig. I mean, I know Craig's got, like, two or three left on his contract. But, I mean, what do you get, like, Jason Statham? Like, I just don't see him as having the class.
No.
Well...
He could do the action stuff. I don't see him as being able to pull off...
I think he could pull off the class... But I just don't want him in that role. I like him doing the types of movies he does now. I think he could pull off the class, but I don't think anybody would see that he could pull it off. because we're so used to the way he is now.
Let's get Joel Schumacher to come in, direct one, and we'll get George Clooney as James Bond. And
nipples on the tuxedo.
There you go.
I'm going to beat you with the best podcaster statue in a moment. That was just wrong. How dare you say that?
Chris O'Donnell as the new M?
Fuck you.
All right, we'll be right back after this break.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Face front, true believers. John Vollmer is an independent artist and illustrator. He has contributed to several indie comics published by Alterna Comics and more, and is able to draw in many styles and genres. John also does commission work in sizes ranging from 3 by 5 inches to 11 by 17 inches and even larger. Add some original art to your personal collection or surprise someone with a drawing just for them. Check out his work at drawnbyjohn.com and his Facebook group, Drawn by John, The Art of John J.C. Vollmer.
All right, welcome back to Shaken Not Stirred. I'm here with Vollmer and Hunter.
Right on.
Blofeld
Vollmer and
Remington Hunter.
What was his name on Chug? Volkov?
Timothy Dalton.
Okay. Guy from Mrs. Doubtfire.
Thomas Crown Affair. There you go.
Were you guys at all familiar with Pierce Brosnan at all before he took on the role?
I think I knew of Remington Steele.
Yeah.
I know he was in Mrs. Doubtfire by that time, I think.
I think we'd all seen Mrs. Doubtfire, and I think he was also doing
Gillette shaving commercials at the time.
I remember that.
So I think I, saw him, I'm like, oh, it's the guy from the razors. But yes, the drive-by fruiting,
yeah. I think we'd all seen him and stuff like that, and everybody knew of Remington Steele. I had never sat down and watched it.
I've never seen it.
Kath
had pictures of him in her locker.
It's a neat series.
The Tailor of Panama, did that come out before you did GoldenEye or after? I think it came out after.
I think after.
Yeah. I remember seeing him in that and just thinking, wow, that's the kind of performance we need.
I just saw him in I saw him in that Simon Pegg movie at the World's End. And okay. He still looks, decent for his age. Better than Roger Moore did at that age.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really know of him much before this. Just I knew that he was quite popular for the role. But I hadn't really seen him in anything to get an impression.
Okay.
Fair enough.
All right, so let's get to the review of GoldenEye. One of you guys want to sum up what the plot is? John?
Well, we're introduced.
John Dean dies again.
Yeah, we finally get to see that there's another 00 agent.
You know, I was about to make tell you guys, I made a note here, Sean Bean dies in every movie.
Yep. Yeah. I really liked that he was 006, because I enjoyed that we had another 00 agent.
Well, didn't we see... I don't know if we saw the agent, but in one of the Connery ones, they at least make mention of, oh, 004 wasn't available, something like that.
And it was
004. There was other agents, but you had never
We'd never seen them
in action.
This was the first time we actually got another 00 on screen, and that was really cool because it wasn't just a myth then.
Yeah, you actually got to see them in action and see that, these are guys that...
And sometimes they work together. Mm-hmm. It was cool. And I really liked the introduction of Brosnan where, we've got... His face is in shadow pretty much for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's on top of this giant dam in Russia. And we get him, our first glimpse of him is upside down, hanging inside the stall of a Russian military shitter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a dude in there, dropping a log.
Well, and he starts with the classic Bond one-liner.
Yeah.
And it just goes from there. And it's just really well-paced. Beginning sequence is just...
Yeah, right up to the beginning credits where we've got the whole sequence where we're running into Sean Bean and, they're setting their timers. We see them working together and all of a sudden we're introduced to our main villain, Zormov. He comes in and it was just a great action sequence to really get you started off with.
And the bike jump off the runway.
Well, yeah, with Sean Bean getting blasted in the face.
Yeah.
And then, Brosnan gets out. And then to run down that runway, after a freaking plane, I would do that.
I want to say this. Between the two movies, he seemed to be the James Bond who liked to punch stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, he also seems to be, because between this and Tomorrow Never Dies, he starts off just nonchalantly walking up to a bad guy, and then punching them in the face. Because Picard never dies. He goes up, lights the cigarette, and then punches them in the face.
Yeah, filthy habit.
Yeah. That's great.
Okay.
He does that. He does that in. He does that twice in Tomorrow Never Dies.
Oh, what's the second?
Later on in the movie,
when he's in China. He does it in China as well.
Oh, yeah, because the guy's, like, just, like, lighting up. He's like, oh, yeah, oh, I got matches here. So, oh, yeah, punch in the face, yeah.
I thought that was great,
Pierce Brosnan, James Bond, stopping smoking everywhere.
Which is funny, because he had always smoked up until Brosnan's movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, yeah.
Well, a different Bond for a different age, right?
What was the different age, right? That was the anti-smoking was really coming into play at that point.
So here's the thing, because we cut after that scene, after the title sequence, to 9 years later.
Yes.
So here's what I observed today, and I just, like, sparked my mind. Because 9 years before 1995 is 1986.
Yep.
Right between Roger Moore and Timothy Dalton. So if you picture this happening real time, because this is that theory we've heard, like we've talked about before, where all the Bonds are different people,
yep.
and Bond is a code name. Where you look at it as, well, maybe Pierce Brosnan was the Bond that took over immediately after Roger Moore, did some missions for a year, had this incident happen where a 006 agent dies, and now he takes time off. And they need to bring in Timothy Dalton to be the next 007 for a couple years. Because the next scene after that, that 9 years later, is him getting a psych evaluation.
Yeah, reassessed for active duty.
Like, that could be him just now needing to be brought back to action. They make comments about, oh, you're a relic of the Cold War. Cold War ended in 1991.
Yeah.
And started around the time that he would have taken over as James Bond from Roger Moore.
I find it awesome that you actually thought of that, because I didn't quite get into the depth that you did, but you're Hunter and you
he's got
you
the best theories, man,
and his theories are awesome, but they're always sound. But I did notice something. I was watching it last night. I only got to get partway through it last night, but I was watching it again, and that was the first time where I actually looked at and realized that it said 9 years later, and I did the timeline as well.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that goes right before Timothy Dalton, so why would that come into play? Because then that might throw the continuity timeline off of how that would work. So maybe he was Bond, but then how does Timothy Dalton? I couldn't quite put it together the way you did, and you pieced it together beautifully. Yeah. But that last night, again, was the first time I actually caught that. So it's awesome that you bring that up.
Well,
because
I'm
glad you put it together, because
the other
makes
part of
it sense.
Is the end of License to Kill, where Timothy Dalton's been was fired early in the movie. They offer him his job back. You don't see him accept it or not. So it's entirely possible he doesn't. And now they need to bring in a new Bond. And maybe it takes another couple years to either, A, go through a bunch of recruits that aren't good enough.
But yeah, it makes perfect sense that maybe there was just no 007 for those years, because you've got 006s and 004s and all these other guys. You know, who knows? Maybe down the way the franchise will go. You know, there was a 007 who did take place in that time frame. So in that what would have been 5 years or 6 year time span, maybe there was somebody else who we just haven't seen their missions yet.
Or there were just so many failed 007 missions. Like, maybe that was
part
of it, too.
They go out and die.
You've got so many guys that's like, all right, you passed your test. You're 007 agent now. Send them out on their first mission, and they die.
Yeah, like when we get to Daniel Craig, we actually find out. I won't give away anything about that movie, but we actually find out that it takes 2 confirmed kills to become a 00 agent.
Yeah.
Any idiot can go out and get 2 kills.
Or, you look at it, if the Cold War ends around 1991, well, maybe now MI6 is getting a lot more pressure to pull back from their activities, right?
Because they're not as
necessary. Oh, we don't need you guys to be there, because if the Russians now, what is now Russia, find out we still have a secret agent service, well, fuck, that's going to screw up now our new diplomatic liaisons, like...
I love your theories, because they're always sound, but this one really, I have to say, when you're looking at comics, it's one thing, but when you look at, like, the James Bond universe, that's something else. That goes beyond comics.
Well, comics are easy to have this sliding timeline. You can just be, okay, whatever, like, time's passed, they're doing
Bond
whatever.
Is based
Bond,
in the now.
You look at it, and the movie is always, what is the current year?
Yeah.
And in your head, you can look at a comic and Wolverine's drawn more or less the same way in the 70s as he is today.
More or less.
So it's more or less. It's the same picture to the audience. But when you have a movie series that goes from like the 60s all the way to now, and the actor's changing, and people look at that, and the scenario around them's changing, the technology changes, and the look, there's discrepancies, and people want to fill in these holes.
Yeah, and they don't tie much together between the different Bonds. There was only that one comparison between Roger Moore losing his wife and then Timothy Dalton having mentioned that he was married once, but no details beyond that. You know, we don't get much tie-in between those. Or the Sean Connery and what's his face?
Lazenby?
Lazenby having the issues with Blofeld and then Roger Moore finishing off Blofeld. So you've got some of that comes into play, but not much overlap between Bonds. So, like, your idea here that maybe, like you said, Brosnan was taken off of duty.
Yeah.
Dalton was thrown in there, and then we have this lapse where we get Brosnan reassessed with that hot little woman who's set to assess him. She can assess
him. And we also, at the same time, like, we get to be reintroduced to, like, the new M. And you have Brosnan making references to, your predecessor.
Kept a bottle of cognac in the top drawer there, yeah.
Yeah. So it's him coming in after a couple of years and going, oh, I know how things used to be.
And it's not the case, yeah.
Saying, oh, well, this is the way I prefer brandy. Like,
and see, now I can look at that whole sequence completely differently because it makes perfect sense that could have come into play. I guess we need to get in contact with, like, the current producers and be like, we've got Hunter. We'd like to write a new Bond movie. Let's get Paul Haggis in contact with Hunter and...
Well, because imagine, like, I mean, they're looking for new ideas. Imagine writing what you were talking about, that Bond story in the middle.
That took place.
Between.
Of, like, two or three Bonds that get killed, and then, like, what could have happened there, right?
Yeah.
That's fascinating, guys.
I like Hunter.
Well, because you get the continuity, too. If you get, like, Desmond Llewellyn still there as Q, and, like, but, I mean, and you'll see it more as, like, the new movies go on of, like, Desmond Llewellyn transitioning himself out for a replacement, and you've got M, the replacements that we've seen for M over the years that do continue. So there's always almost like they've had a sense of continuity, but the character has been there and they just leave it as unexplained.
It's just hinted at that the character of Bond has always been there, but it's not necessarily confirmed that that's always been the Bond. And I really like, as we get further in, when we get to see the new Q, as things progress, you know, some of the things that are explained in movies that we're going to get to with these reviews, things that kind of come out that link back to the older films or the older continuity that kind of give you these ways to think about what could have happened.
Because here's the step further that you can take with this with Tomorrow Never Dies, where he was in a relationship with Terry Hatcher and something went wrong. What if that something went wrong was him coming back from Russia?
A different.
And Alec didn't.
Yeah.
And that's what caused that breakup. They go their separate ways.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, there you go. Anyways, so yeah, plot. We've got Russians have developed a super weapon that produces an electromagnetic pulse. To knock out all electronic devices in a 30-mile radius.
A nuclear device in space, a nuclear satellite set to target a specific EMP on a precise location. In this particular case, Severnaya in Russia. A supposedly abandoned military installation and monitoring station that is not abandoned whatsoever.
Yeah, it's an outpost for the space division of Russia. And you get glimpses of what's going on where we meet Famke Janssen in a nice car chase.
Oh, and her thigh-killing action.
Her thigh-killing action. And I need to pull up this word because I wrote it down because I needed to know what this was because I looked at her through this whole movie and I'm like, okay, clearly she is turned on by killing.
Yes.
So the term for that is erotophonophilia, which is somebody that is erotically turned on by killing people.
That would explain
her. And
that
she was.
So there you go. So we meet her with the cool car chase and then see her and kill an admiral after getting beaten in the car chase by Bond, and then beaten in cards.
The last time in the Bond series that we see them play Baccarat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The last time Bond plays that, because as we move forward,
we get into now today,
Texas Hold'em, which is what everybody else is playing. So. But yeah, this is the last time that we get to see. This is kind of like our homage to basically just Sean Connery and Roger Moore. You know, the only times that we ever saw him in the books or in the movies playing cards was Baccarat. Brosnan plays it against Xenia Zergeva on a top.
On a top?
On a top.
Okay.
And yeah, after this film, we don't see that him in a casino playing that game anymore, which is a shame because I always thought it was...
It was a classic.
I thought it was cool. I'm not really a... I like playing Hold'em. I don't like watching it, but yeah, they have this little interlude before she kills the admiral, but
yeah.
But why does she kill the admiral, Hunter?
Well, she kills an admiral because there is a top secret prototype helicopter.
The Tiger Eurocopter.
The Tiger Eurocopter, which is immune to electromagnetic radiation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. What use could you have for that?
I suppose that would be perfect if you wanted to steal a Soviet nuclear weapon that's in space and you know, can attack a specific location on the ground.
No, that helicopter's not important. We don't need to follow up with that.
No, I don't think we will. And that's what happens with the new M, right? She doesn't... her numbers, her accounting, as they put it, the evil queen of numbers, she doesn't feel that it's a threat, so they don't pursue it when Bond realizes that it's being stolen. And so that's where Bond really comes back into play with seeing, oh, shit, yeah, we just found your chopper. It is important. Why is it in this location that's supposedly abandoned?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow, some nuclear blast just occurred. What happened?
Well, we got an alarm sounding at this place that was supposed to be abandoned. We took a look at it, and your stolen helicopter's here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we get Nightcrawler as a computer hacker.
Okay, still to date, my favorite role of Alan Cummings. Boris is such a fun character.
I am invincible.
But, you know, he's this computer programmer who's also a hacker, and he's working with the Russian Space Division, and he's got these fun little games he plays with the women in the office, you know, locking the computers.
Because not sexual harassment at all.
Oh, yeah.
It's Bond. There's no such thing as sexual harassment.
Thank God for Bond.
You know, he's playing these gigs where he locks their computers and they need to get the password. They got to guess the password. So he uses riddles. Like, they're in front of you and they can open very large doors. Knockers.
Yeah.
You know, it's great. So it's fun. He's a really fun character. He's very dynamic and adventurous.
The only thing I don't get out of it is I don't get his motivation. Like, we never end up
money.
It just always comes down to money, but I guess, like, you never get anything beyond, okay...
I think it's
we don't know why he was evil.
It's mentioned later on that he did it for money, because she asks him, and he's like, you know, Russian Space Division doesn't pay you dick all, and they offered me all this money. Mm-hmm. So it's great that he feels appreciated and that he's getting this ton of cash, but this character is just so off the wall and out there. I still to this day will just run through the house, I'll trip, bounce my head off the wall or something like that, and get up, and I'm invincible! I need a cigarette.
And I love that they foreshadow the pen.
Yes.
So early on. Like, he's flipping it around at the Space Division, so it's like
before we've even seen that there's going to be a mission. Pen. So yeah, it's this, oh, wait a minute, you know it's going to end up in his hands. What's going to happen? Is that's how he's going to die?
Yeah.
You know, it's great.
So yeah, so the Russians steal it.
Well, there's two satellites. They set one off it up that they stole, and the second one using the Tiger
Eurocopter. And we've got one survivor and Boris. We've got our new Smetrova. Or Smirnov.
No. Smirnov. She's hot, though.
Another one of the Russian...
Smirnova. She was hot.
Smirnova, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's now, like, the only survivor here. She knows who the traitor was.
She knows it was Orimov.
And Boris.
And on a top, and Boris. Yeah. She knows... Well, she doesn't know Boris was involved. She just knows he's missing.
No, because when he first asks her, like, who's the inside man, she names Boris.
Oh, that's right, because he was gone.
Yeah. So she names Boris, and she's doing her own investigation, too. I love her scene in the computer shop.
Yeah, the IBM shop in Russia.
The IBM shop in Russia, where she's like, yes, madam would require one test computer. It's like, is everything...
And a quiet
is
place,
yeah. Is everything satisfactory? Everything except the interruption.
Yeah.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah, that was great. The great sequence. You know, she walks into this computer store, and she knows what she needs to get onto a network and contact Boris. So she pretends that she's with a school board, and she's going to order this massive pile of computers, and all of a sudden the salesman's all interested.
Yep.
And she gets in to test out these machines with no intention of doing it.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's nice to see, like,
a smart woman,
that female character, like, actually trying to do something on her own. Like, she ends up getting captured a couple times.
And becomes the damsel in distress again, but, yeah, you're right.
But at the same time, like, on the one hand, like, she makes contact with Boris on her own. Towards the end of the movie, she encrypts the satellite when they're trying to set off their master plan of essentially robbing all the banks in London. She's the one that realigns the antenna and encrypts it. Like, without that, they don't win.
Yeah.
She gets captured again, but...
Yeah, it's great that we actually get a female character in the Bond universe that has something to contribute that Bond never could do.
And the hacking at the end is what leads them to Cuba.
Yes.
Because she spikes and sends a computer trace and...
Spike them!
Yeah.
Alright, let's hold our thoughts there, and we'll come back with some more GoldenEye and some Tomorrow Never Dies as well.
Stay tuned, loyal listeners. There's more We Got the Geek still to come.
Kristen Hunter is a Canadian artist specializing in polymer clay creations. Kristen is a geek at heart, and most of her creations are nerd-themed. She makes everything from Captain America earrings to video game-inspired necklaces and everything else in between. Check out Kristen's amazing work at www.wasabeads.com or visit her Facebook group, Wasabeads Custom Creations.
All right, welcome back. I'm here with Brosnan Ballmer and, Connery Hunter.
Okay.
Come on!
I didn't have time to prepare.
I can accept that. That's fine.
But we were talking about some of the new characters that came out of GoldenEye. Yeah. Judi Dench as M. Fantastic, by the way. Doesn't take any shit from him.
I liked it because it was a nice change up to the interactions that he normally has with women. And you see it evolve nicely over the course of the four movies that he interacts with her, so...
Yeah,
these are good.
I really liked her because she reminded me very much of Bernard Lee, our original M. You know, I didn't like the guy we had in between. I thought he was kind of lame. But Bernard Lee was really the take no shit.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to do what I tell you. You're going to do it now. You're going to like it. And you're not going to give me a hard time about it kind of boss.
And we even see that from, like, we see that from M, but also at the same time, like, even the evolution from that character into... Tomorrow Never Dies, where we see her letting Bond have that free reign, where they're like, what the hell is he doing? And she just comes out and says, he's doing his job.
Yeah, she trusts him, right? So that's something that we get that we don't see with Bernard Lee back in the day, but I like that our introduction to Judi Dench is her being just like him. Her being a badass saying, you know what, I don't give a shit if you don't like me. Suck it up, you know, Buttercup. This is what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sending you out there, and if you die... Oh, well, you're expendable. So she really puts her foot down and shows that she belongs in that seat, even though nobody else in the office sees it that way. And I liked that was our introduction to her. She does a good job over,
like, I mean, seven movies with Judi Dench. Because you get the four Brosnan and you get the three Daniel Craig ones have all been Judi Dench as M. And it's been fantastic. Like,
yeah, she really, fantastic. I really enjoyed her as M, I think. Because I preferred Bernard Lee for so long.
She gets to do a lot more, too. Like, they actually have...
Yeah,
she gets... And particularly, like, The World Is Not Enough. Like, she has more of a central role in that.
Yeah, she serves she has a purpose.
Role, she has a major role in Skyfall.
And she's a serious set of brains behind a lot of what goes on. So we get a lot of interaction, you know, where we didn't get with previous M's, where they're just there, they give him the mission, send him on his way. Now we have we're getting cuts like in the middle, all throughout the movie of her
being in contact with Bond or sending him out to do something specifically, and then we're seeing how she's interacting with other people while Bond's out in the field.
Yeah, it's nice seeing the, like, what's going on back at the office. Like, too much of it wouldn't have been good, but every so often to get the glimpse that there's still activity happening on the other
side.
And
there's people watching what Bond's doing. Yeah. Like, they're keeping abreast of what's happening, so it's not just Bond out in the field doing everything on his own. And she really brought a lot of great stuff, you know, with all of these elements into the M role.
Yeah.
I agree. And I'm going to get crucified for saying this. I like the movie. And keep in mind, this is my first time seeing it. Thought it dragged at times. Maybe I was in a bad mood or tired. Or
really? I didn't find Goldeneye to drag.
I can see parts of it that might drag.
See, that's what I get out of Tomorrow Never Dies. Mm-hmm. But I thought Goldeneye was just... I thought the pace was excellent because I was like, I always get
I'll
high
agree
energy
like
watching that.
I'll agree that way a little bit about Tomorrow Never Dies because I was watching it today and I'm like, oh shit, they haven't even done the Vietnam stuff.
Yeah,
like,
boring as hell.
Anyways, but no, like I mean, like I can understand there might be little bits and pieces. Like I like the exchange with Robbie Coltrane with Minnie Driver singing in the background.
Oh,
but
awesome.
I will say the tank chase was one of my favorite Bond chases up to this point.
One of the best chases in Bond.
Yeah. But it is long.
Yeah.
Like, I can understand, too, why you might think that the movie drags when you've got a chase scene like that that does go on a long time. Like, it's very reminiscent of the boat chase. Like, it's very reminiscent of the boat chase in Live and Let Die. Because it is very long. Like, when you think things are over, oh, somebody shows up again, and you're, like, back on that trail. Like,
I can see that a little bit, but, you know, I really
good,
enjoyed
though.
That, yeah.
Cool.
What did you think of the villain?
I like the villain. I've always, since X-Men, I've had a crush on Famke Janssen. I'm not going to lie.
I've had a crush on her since Goldeneye.
I think she's yummy. I even wrote it here. So it's great seeing her.
You did, too.
I enjoyed seeing her.
She
oh,
is
yeah.
yummy.
Her and the Wolverine too, by the way. Hello.
Yeah. Oh, that's a snack I'd love to get my hands on.
But yeah, she was great. Like you said, Alan Cumming was great in the movie. Funny as hell.
Even the guy who played Orimov, I really liked him. I thought he was a prick.
He's a prick, but there are times that I look at him, particularly in that hat, and go, man, you look like a child dressed in your dad's clothes. that hat just looks so huge on him. That he walks in and he takes it off and this thing's just like freaking motorcycle helmet under his arm as he delivers his report to the Russians. Like,
but really when it comes down to it, is that all the villains?
No, there is a very important one. One who without his death, we would not have the meme that it is.
Well, spoiler for like a 20-year-old movie, but Mr. Sean Bean, of course, who was not dead.
He was not dead. He was actually behind the whole thing, orchestrating it from behind the scenes. And he becomes Yanis. Head of the Yanis Syndicate, which is mentioned throughout the film.
Mm-hmm. The two-faced god, because his parents were, of course, Lien's Cossacks, who defected from the Nazis to work with the British, who were then, in turn, betrayed by the British. And this is why he is now pissed off, because he was sort of drafted by the British military and Secret Service after his parents had been killed, because they were like, oh, he's young, he's going to forget. But he grows up harboring a grudge, and this is his thing. He's going to destroy the London economy, take all their money, and just leave them back in the Stone Age.
And let's also point out that he's not just holding a grudge against Britain in general for this, but he's also holding a grudge against Bond because the timers that were supposed to be set for 6 minutes that were part of his master plan to escape, you know, covering up a fake death.
Yeah.
You know, Bond changed those timers at the beginning of the movie to 3 minutes for his escape, thinking
that
Sean Bean was dead.
Sean Bean is dead. And the constant constant sort of for England that the two of them have at the beginning, like that they're doing this for their country and it's just for their country, but it comes back to it that it is personal for both of them.
Yeah.
Because you feel like Alec, which is 006, feels betrayed by both the British government, and he uses Bond as, like, the personification of that.
Yeah.
And Bond's haunted by the idea that he felt this whole time that he got Alec killed. and probably led to whatever, like 9 years between it.
We do see that, you know, Alec is holding a serious grudge because he's physically scarred from this. He didn't get out because his plan was kind of foiled a bit. So he, you know, this becomes a factor where, you know, he gives Bond, when Bond's been captured at one point, in the same 6 minutes that he gave, that Bond gave him, to escape out of the chopper as he's
trying
to
definitely plays into, like, without being like an overt I really hate you and I'm gonna destroy you, a like, you are on my mind as a source of pain.
Mm-hmm.
So no, he was good. He was a good villain.
He was,
he was a good villain, but I will point out he was a dumb villain. Because, and this is my problem with watching this again today, if he had not shot at the plane that Bond was flying over the lake in Cuba, Bond would have left, and his plane would have gone off without a hitch.
Bond never would have known he was there.
Because Bond and Smirnov fly around and say, one more pass. They're going to make one more circle of the island,
and then give
and
up.
And then they're going to leave. They're going to go to a new island. And just as they're leaving, they get shot at. And that's how you know. And they even, like, after the lake strain, they're like, oh my god, that's why we didn't see it. And I look at that and go, well, if you just hadn't shot them, they would have left, you would have been able to engage your plan, and everything would have been fine.
Yeah.
But no, you had to take a shot at them.
But let's face it, you can't have a movie villain without one stupid move being made to progress the story that bit.
Well, okay, no, there are multiple stupid moves at that point. There are a lot of, I'm going to shoot you in the face. No, I'm going to put you into a, like, prototype super helicopter.
And then blow
it up. Blow it up. Or, I'm going to blow up my own train with you still on it. When I could have just shot you in the back when you turned to rescue the girl. Like,
especially when he points out, you know, good luck with the floor. Knowing that he's going to use his watch to cut through it with the laser.
Yeah, like, I heard that at first. And I was expecting something, like, in the floor that would prevent him from doing that. Because you look at it and, like, this is a 00 agent. He's got to know all the secrets. And you get that a little bit later on when Bond sets up the charges. And Bean, like, pulls out his watch and goes, oh, okay, like, newer model, but it's still this button and turns off the bombs.
Yeah.
Anytime I see stuff like that in the Bond movies now, I can't help but think of Scott Evil in Austin Powers.
Yeah.
I got a gun in my room. Let's just kill him now.
No, and that's my problem. Like,
oh my
god. And
that's why that joke works, is because no Bond villain ever does that.
The Bond universe seems to be the only one where the good guys will just shoot anybody they see on sight. Or stab anybody they want on sight. But the bad guys will take the time and go, whoa, whoa, whoa. We gotta take this guy hostage.
I want you to suffer.
And talk to him first.
Yeah, like, I need you to suffer before you die.
But
I gotta make sure I'm not present,
like,
when you die.
Could you just, like, I'm sorry, if you just shot James Bond in the head.
Which might have been what happened.
Then put his body in.
Maybe that's what was happening between Dalton and Brosnan, right? Yeah. Those years of the failed 007s that were
theoretical. Maybe they ran across villains that were actually smart and able to just shoot them on sight. Like,
yeah.
There's just too many cases where it's like, no. Just kill them. You get that a little bit in Tomorrow Never Dies as well.
Yeah, which we're going to move on to after the break. But, guys, I want to hear your rating for this movie.
Really, when it comes down to this, for Goldeneye, for me, I give it 4.5 out of 5. Walter, PPKs.
Hunter?
I will give it... I will give it 2 Famke Janssen thighs plus 2
That's enough,
knockers.
Sir. That's enough, sir.
10 out of 5.
And like I said, I think I was tired when I watched it and it dragged a bit. I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5 thigh crack and Jean Grays.
There you go.
Nice. Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll run through Tomorrow Never Dies. So stay tuned.
Hold on, true believers. There's more We Got the Geek after these words.
Mostly Comics has been serving the Niagara region for over 30 years. The store sells a variety of comics and entertainment-related products, including graphic novels, toys, and collectibles. Mostly also purchases rare comics upon appraisal. Visit Kim and the Gang at 413 St. Paul Street in St. Catharines, or check out their website at www.mostlycomics.com.
All right, welcome back to the show. We have Hunter and Balmer and a nice raging fire. Yes. Reminiscent of the explosions in the Bond movies, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes, but that one didn't explode. That was set deliberately and casually.
Yes.
In a protected environment.
So we're going to move on to Tomorrow Never Dies, which I'm thinking I liked more than you guys did from all the discussion about it.
I don't actually mind it. I feel like it has... I'm going to start off by saying, like, as the basic premise is...
Excellent premise.
A media mogul that has decided to make his own news.
Yeah.
And... especially looking at the 24-hour news networks of today and watching it again today,
completely
you look
believable.
At that and it's completely believable. It is a very modern Bond story.
It's CNN.
It's
what it is.
It is CNN
and he reminded
with
me,
a little Steve Jobs.
Yes, he
like
reminded me of
Steve
Jobs.
Steve Jobs mixed with Rupert Murdoch, the media mogul behind, like, Fox and, like, yeah.
Yeah,
but
I love the premise.
I love the idea because it does even play well today. I think it plays well today better
it
than it did when it came out.
Yeah, because the news wasn't everywhere the way it is now back then.
Like, today, you look at, like, Fox News, CNN, NBC. Like, there are so many 24-hour news networks that try and make big things out of nothing. And you can see them building... things to attack and things to hate now. And to have somebody that's like, oh, I'm going to make World War III and I'm going to make this...
I'm going to have
make
a,
this
exclusive
all my money.
Coverage of it. Yeah.
Yeah. As I launch my new media network that everybody is going to be a part of.
And he had a cool submarine with Blade on it. No?
What?
Blade?
Yeah, the saw...
Oh, the drill torpedo.
Well, the
yeah.
drill wasn't on a sub. That was on a stealth boat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It took out a sub.
No,
cut.
It was a carrier.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, a warship.
So I'm going to point this out to you guys. I know you didn't get to watch it last night, but Hunter did.
Well, I've seen it many times, so I'm familiar with it.
Did you notice the actor with M at the beginning of the movie who showed up throughout?
Oh, the Admiral. Yes.
Yes, it was Oliver Queen's stepfather from
Romero. The black guy. No, I was thinking of the Admiral, because the Admiral I've seen in quite a bit of stuff, too.
He was quite famous, you know, around that time and leading up to that, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, the black guy you're talking about, I can't remember even his name.
The actor's name is Colin Salmon, and I'm like sitting there going, Kath, is that Arrow's stepfather? And yeah, it was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, same actor. And actually, he did a couple of Bond movies, and I really enjoyed
it. Yeah, I think he's in the next one,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I enjoyed his character. He was in A World Is Not Enough as well. And I dig his character. It was
so cool. Just looking through my notes here, and you had mentioned, like, his first appearance in the movie is punching out a guy, which I loved.
Yeah, no, it's a great setup because you don't even need to see Bond right away, and you already know he's there. Because you already got them talking like, oh, our agent out there.
Yeah.
And before anything else, like, you know it's Bond that's over there.
007 is always
there.
Their top pick.
So, that's great to see what the other side of the mission that he's going on is. Like, to see that everybody else second-guessing or supporting his decision while he's doing... the hard stuff of being shot at by, like, 24 people while he's trying to steal a plane with nukes to prevent it from being blown up.
Yeah.
And this whole, you know, arms event that's going on that leads us into the opening credits. You know, we get to see Ricky Jay is in this movie.
Yes.
And Ricky Jay, I like him in just about everything I see him in. He's awesome. You know, he was in Boogie Nights and he was on Deadwood. Just a great actor. I really enjoy his stuff.
I loved every fight scene in this movie, by the way.
Every action scene?
Every action scene, every fight scene. The remote control car scene was fantastic.
The remote control car scene is good. I like that. I mean, really, it was a touch phone before there was touch phones.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, really. It was a touchpad, like a portable touchpad.
My only problem with that is that they make such a big deal about not being able to get into the car. They're like... hitting it with crowbars, hitting it with sledgehammers, shooting at it, can't get into the car, so they need to stop Bond from being shot so that they can try and get the codes to try and get in. As soon as Bond jumps into the car, front windshield, rear windshield are both destroyed so that a rocket launcher can go straight through it.
Yep.
I looked at that and went, no, wait a second. If you guys can fire a grenade launcher at this and crack that front windshield, why is James Bond still alive?
That's true. It was great. And is this the first time we've seen a Bond motorcycle chase as well? When him and Michelle Yao were handcuffed and on the bike?
I think so.
I don't recall any motorcycle chases off the top of my head in previous ones.
Because this was, it was cool.
I think there might have been one or two where it was him in a car and the bad guys in a motorcycle.
Yeah, but yeah. Never Bond on the motorcycle.
No.
That was awesome.
And I loved it. It was a great, it was a freaking beautiful bike.
It was a really good, good chase.
A great chase, but a nice bike and... Well, let's face it.
I will also point out...
I would love to be handcuffed on a motorcycle to Michelle Yeoh.
Oh, another time, the bad guys could have shot him, and they didn't. Because they stop right at that balcony, helicopter comes up, is level with the window, guy's been shooting at them the whole time, doesn't fire into the window at all.
Nope.
No.
But, no, I really like the concept, like, I really like the bad guy's plan. I felt like it was a good plan. It wasn't just, ha, I'm going to have world domination... I am actually going to do something groundbreaking that I'm going to have control over. And it was really neat.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, the actor was necessarily the right guy for the role. He wasn't...
Oh, I don't know. I think Jonathan Pryce was very smarmy enough in that.
He was too Weasley to me. And I get that that was what was needed, but I would have liked to see him being meaner, I guess. I think he was too Weasley and not mean enough for me to really like his character, but I like how Weasley he was. I love his idea and his premise and what he was doing. I like that he had this tough guy henchman to kind of take care of shit for him, even though he
Dolph Lundgren.
He couldn't act to get himself out of a room.
I will say this too, like, you get this stark wake up of technology then and now, where you see Bond with the touchpad driving his car. And then when he's facing the assassin in the hotel room, assassin pulls out a VHS tape and is like, ah, this is going to be on the news. And you're like, oh, VHS tapes. Like,
it was a heavy mix of transitioning technology for sure.
What is the deal with the dirty Miss Moneypenny they have now, by the way?
Bond?
Bond is so
very
good.
Very cute, though.
She's by far my favorite Moneypenny.
Yeah.
Out of all of them.
Oh, wow.
She has a fun scene. I think my favorite scene of hers is in the last Pierce Brosnan one.
Yes.
Because I always believe that when Brosnan retires from the role of James Bond, he takes Moneypenny with him. I think that was always my belief, was that at the end of the fourth one, he retires and goes off to be with Moneypenny. Like, because you never see her again. She's one of the few people that doesn't go over into the sort of Casino Royale kind of thing. In fact, they have a new Moneypenny.
She comes in
but she's only there she's only there for the Pierce Brosnan runs, and I like that they play with it.
And she's hot.
Oh, she's
gorgeous. My God.
She always thought he was a cunning linguist.
Yes.
Yeah.
I laughed at that.
Wait till you see one of her innuendos with The World Is Not Enough. The cigar tube?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, she was cute.
She's my favorite Moneypenny because she's a smartass. She's a little bit dirty.
Well, yeah.
Like, she's gorgeous.
The original Moneypenny was just a, oh, I'm being sexually harassed and I'm going to wag my finger, but...
Yeah.
The other one, like, this was the one that could, like, bite back, too.
Lois Maxwell was great for that generation of Bond. Samantha Bond's Moneypenny.
She is the kind of Moneypenny that you look at M and go, that's exactly the secretary that M would have.
Yes, because the Moneypenny we get for Timothy Dalton's version is an 80s updated version of Lois Maxwell, and that's it. That's all she is. She's just the secretary who's there.
Well, and that's the thing. It's very easy to just write that as just the secretary, and I like that they took the time
to try and develop some
secondary characters. Make Moneypenny an actual
character, yeah.
I love Desmond Llewellyn scene.
Oh, the insurance scene?
Like, it's just great. Like, all right, I'm here to hand you over your car. Will you need a fire? Yeah, probably. And the look on his face, like, all right.
Well, let's just face it. Like, Desmond Llewellyn, through all of the Bonds and really anything he's done, he's just an awesome actor. You know, I really enjoyed that he did as many as he did.
Mm-hmm.
Because he really made up this character like no one else could have.
Well, this was the 18th Bond movie, and his 17th movie, he sat out Live and Let
Die.
The only
one he's not in is Dr. No.
No, Live and Let Die.
Oh, Live and Let Die?
Yeah.
Yeah, he appears in Dr. No briefly.
Yeah, Live and Let Die, I guess he was out of the country or something.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Oh, yeah, I guess so.
But, yeah, he was great in it as well. Michelle Yeoh, was fantastic. Yeah, in her scenes.
It was right around the time of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, she was just getting popular, like, in the American movies.
But we also had Terry Hatcher just coming off of the success of the Lois and Clark
series. She was useless in this movie.
She was definitely very, very useless.
I usually like her, too. Like, she was on MacGyver.
Well, she served one purpose. She gave M a reason to send Bond after Carver. She gave them that link. That was it. And
it also let you have a little bit of that. Like, I mean, like, I used her in my sort of, like, theory about Brosnan. Like,
it gives you that theory that, you know, of different things that he was involved with in the past. So she's, you know, it's always great when you get some element of Bond's past because there's so few of them.
Well, like Hunter was saying, like, third in the credits, dead after the first 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Like, she lasts until just after the party scene.
Yeah.
And it's probably, like, 20 minutes is an exaggeration because, I mean, the opening teaser.
She gets five minutes of screen time.
Like, she gets really, like, three scenes. She gets, like, the scene at the party.
Yeah, the introduction.
She gets the scene with her husband. And then she gets the scene in the hotel room with Bond.
And then she's
a corpse.
Yeah.
But let's face it, it is Terry Hatcher.
Yeah.
She sucks at acting.
I like her.
In my opinion. I know like a lot of people like her, and I know she's done things since that
she
I haven't seen.
She played a great transporter chief in Star Trek The Next Generation.
Okay.
One episode.
Okay.
Can we mention the car, then?
The car was cool. The car was really cool. I liked the wire cutter, the rocket launcher out of the back, out of the top, the caltrops.
I liked the wire cutter.
I would like my car to have a rocket launcher. Driving down the QEW sometimes.
I like that model of BMW. Mm. That's just, when I watch that movie, I see that BMW and I'm like, I still want that BMW.
I love the Aston Martin Vanquish from the fourth one as a car.
Yeah.
Not what they did to it necessarily, but as a car, I think that car is beautiful. But
the funny thing about that car is that in the remake of The Italian Job, that's the car that Jason Statham wants.
Yes.
Was the Aston Martin Vanquish. So you kind of get that tie for fans of, you know, who would be the next Bond kind of thing.
But
yeah, that, I don't know, that BMW, I loved it.
Oh, it was great. It was great. I want to mention, sometimes we talk about the music in these things. The Sheryl Crow song, I'm actually...
It's one of my favorite
Me too.
Bond
I was thinking
it's a
of,
good Bond
theme, I would put it in my top five Bond themes.
Yep.
I can understand that. It was really well done. It was really good.
I love that Bono and The Edge wrote a Tina Turner
song
for GoldenEye.
Again,
that was another great one.
I read today that the Stones had been approached to do the theme for GoldenEye, and they said no.
Wow.
Yeah.
No.
That's good.
Tomorrow Never Dies is
Richards
probably like my second or third. I really enjoy the Casino Royale one. Chris Cornell's You Know My Name is a really well done one because its lyrics are so like on the nose to the franchise. Like, the content of it is very attached to the character in the movie, whereas I don't really feel like the songs, other than having the title, have really connected to the movie in the right way.
Quantum of Solace had a good opening scene.
Quantum of Solace.
A song that fit with it pretty good.
But no, Casino Royale is probably my favorite. I enjoy Live and Let Die a lot.
Oh,
like, it's just
a
good song.
Damn right. I love the Duran Duran one, too.
Yeah, and I like the one from Aha.
I even like that one.
Didn't Queen do one, too?
No, they didn't, actually. That would have been great, though.
That would have been awesome, yeah.
But yeah, no,
Queen
there's
doing,
like
The Spy Who Loved Me or something like that.
But,
Freddie Mercury singing The Spy Who Loved Me. That would be great.
Yeah.
Goldfinger. Freddie Mercury singing Goldfinger.
Oh, man.
No, Tomorrow Never Dies is one of my favorite songs. It's actually on my like music player.
I love it. It's great. Pretty cool opening credits, too, I thought.
Circuit board paint job on the girls.
Yeah. Anything else you guys want to say about this one, or...?
Well, there's a lot of great elements to this one. You know, like you said, the stealth boat, the drill, the whole premise behind the movie, the way they're implementing it, you can really kind of see how somebody like that can put this together when they've built such a big empire. You know, with Ricky Jay's involvement, them stealing that encoder to throw off the boundaries of where these ships think they are.
I feel like he was underused. Like, I feel like
absolutely.
He was just there to have the encoder at the beginning, and I feel like he did nothing else the rest of the movie.
There's so much more that that character could have done, especially when you open his safe to get the encoder, and you see that there's a pile of money, a bag of coke, and
yeah,
pornos and stuff like that.
And a porno bag, like...
There's so... You can clearly see that this character has a lot going on. He should have been used more.
Definitely.
He really
yeah,
wasn't.
I feel like this was the movie of just underused characters.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I felt like they knew enough that they wanted an old love interest of Bond, but they had nothing else to do with her after that.
They
so,
had a,
okay,
they
we'll
had a Weasley
off.
Villain,
like,
but they didn't make him
oh,
mean enough.
We probably want, like, oh, if the British are going to send their agent, well, I bet the Chinese would send their own agent, but really, I feel like most of the time she only just screws things up.
Yeah.
Especially early on where she, like, breaks into the facility, sets off the alarms, and then, like... Later on, she's got the cool sort of Bondish hideout.
Yeah. But you're right. That really, I think, is what hits it on the nose for me for this one, which is why I don't care for this one as much, is because the characters in it were so underutilized.
Yeah.
It's like they all scraped the surface of what they really could have been, and then it didn't go any further. So I leave this movie always wanting more out of it.
Okay.
That's my trouble with this one.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, I just want to ask you quickly, Michelle Yeoh, would you have paid money to see her in a spinoff movie? Because I guess that was the plan.
No.
Okay.
Not.
Then
not,
it's a good thing it didn't happen, I
not
guess.
Not a spy-type movie. I love watching just about everything else she's in because I think she's fantastic as the character she plays in things like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and stuff like that.
I will say I love Jonathan Pryce's, like, when she goes to, like, kick him, and he does yeah,
great.
It's absolutely hilarious, but her as a spy...
I don't buy, like, she just didn't seem confident enough.
She seemed confident and capable, but you're right, not competent enough to be that kind of level to need her own spinoff.
Okay. And I guess Anthony Hopkins was originally cast as Elliot Carver.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah. I think that would have given me the edgier version of the Weasley guy that I would have been looking for. Yeah. I think he would have been a better choice. Don't get me wrong.
I do appreciate that Jonathan Pryce at one point goes, can you just out and out kill them now?
Yeah.
And then, of course, has Bond in front of him and doesn't shoot him.
Yeah.
But... No, I appreciated aspects of it. I like the plot. I wish that it had been something that they could have really
They didn't sink
with.
Their teeth into it.
My other problem with it is it's another... It's our only... Our second Pierce Brosnan James Bond, and it's another using a satellite as a weapon movie. And even the beginning is a Russian facility with a plane that Bond escapes in. Like, there was already a couple things that were already too repetitive. Or, like, halfway through the movie, there's the chase on a unique vehicle. In this case, it was the bike as opposed to the tank. Like,
yeah.
Or Bond and girl are infiltrating the facility at the end. Girl gets captured and Bond has to save her. Like,
yeah, well, there was a few... As we go through the Brosnan run, things that you're pointing out now carried on even through the next two. Very cliched, specific things that just kind of have to happen.
Are there any ski chases or people that own sharks?
The ski chase comes up in the next one.
Oh, good.
And the chase...
is it the next one or is it the fourth
one? It's in The World Is Not Enough. He's got the ski chase.
Oh.
With the parahawks.
Oh, yes. Yes, and he does have the ski chase, but there's also the board. Well, it's more like
you get the paraboarding and the chase in the unique vehicle in the fourth one.
Yeah.
So a lot of the satellite in the fourth one.
So
you get a lot of elements.
Three out of four Pierce Brosnan movies require a satellite weapon of some kind.
All right, guys. So
or a defigured, injured villain.
Well, that comes up in the third one.
And the fourth one. Diamond
yes,
Face.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Diamond Face.
Diamond Face.
There's a little teaser for you, Jay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I look forward to
but
it.
But yeah, no, like, I mean, like, I felt like there was definitely, like, a film formula
that was
they
specific
just,
for
that
just
they just filled
four.
In. Like, they filled in for this just to try and churn out a movie every two
and,
years.
And it's only for these four.
Yeah.
It's they basically
well,
look back at
the
previous
problem.
Bond movies, and they were like, okay, these are the things that have to happen in every Bond movie,
well,
so we're
going
to make sure
of,
one of them happens in each one of ours.
Well, and that's that law of diminishing returns. The first time it's really cool in GoldenEye, but as you go through...
It's just like, really, is this
all
happening?
That's left is, like, with the substance that the audience has already seen, they're looking for other sources, and you're just giving them flash that's not really well produced. Like, particularly the CGI in the fourth one, I feel, is really bad.
Yeah.
But,
My prediction for the next two is that you'll like the next one and not care so much for the fourth one.
Maybe we'll split
there
up the next two.
There are parts of the fourth one I enjoy, because, man, I love Frost.
There's a lot of good stuff in the fourth one.
But, yes. But anyways.
Yeah, maybe we'll split those two up then.
Okay.
So, I'm going to my rating first. I'm going to say 4 out of 5 dead Terry Hatchers.
That's a pretty
I really
rating.
Liked it, man.
For me, for Tomorrow Never Dies, I'll give it 3 rocket burned out killed dead Mr. Stampers out of 5.
I'm going to give it a World War III out of 5.
Okay.
Okay.
That's so, what he wanted to start.
Yeah, it is.
So this is probably the last one we're going to do this year. I actually started this last December. So this this is the 18th official Bond movie. I watched 19 Bond movies this year because we did Never Say Never Again as well.
Yeah, the unofficial one, yeah.
And,
which is great.
I would have been done with the
Ultra Thunderball.
Yeah, the Roger Moore one slowed us down because by the time they were over, we needed a break. So, but it was a good project. I got to thank you because the genesis of this show was you 12 months ago saying, I can't believe you've never seen a Bond movie.
Yeah, it blew my mind that somebody that I know has never seen Bond, and it just had to happen because, like, I go through the Bond movies every year. I watch them over and over again. I've read the books. I love the Bond universe. And I regularly go back and watch a lot of them. There's a few that I don't touch. I watch them once every couple of years. But there's some Bond movies I watch damn near every month.
He's almost like an action hero version of Doctor Who, where, like, it's the same similar kind of stories, but you just have a different Bond with a slightly different personality, but the MO is still the same, like...
It's one of those things where, you know, I'm at home drawing or I'm doing something around the house or working on some fishing equipment, getting it ready or something like that. You throw Bond on, and when you've seen them enough, it plays in your mind without you looking at the screen. Mm-hmm. You know exactly what's happening. And, you know, there's a lot of movies that we watch that are like that. I can do that with Star Wars, but I don't want to take my eyes off of Star Wars.
Yeah.
But with Bond movies, I don't have to be watching the screen to really enjoy it because it's all going on. You hear everything. It's great. So I'm glad that we got you to do this, and I'm really looking forward to you getting into the Daniel Craig ones. But I really want to see your opinion of the next two Brosnan, because the 4 of Brosnan, 1 and 3 for me, were the best. 2 and 4, weaker.
4 is definitely the weakest. I'm up in the air between 2 and 3.
I think 4's worst.
I have to watch 3 again.
4's worst element was Halle Berry, but we'll get to that on
all
the
right.
review.
All right, so I guess I got 5 more to do before this segment's done. So
yeah, and by that time we'll probably have
the next one's not for till 2015. Though.
Yeah,
if
but
he
we
takes
we should,
him a year to get through 5 when he's already done 18 in a year.
But by the time we get through the next group, we should have a good idea of what the next one will be. It won't be out, but we should have a good idea of what the next.
We'll
one will
do
be.
The next Brosnan one in January, I guess, and. Thanks, guys, for coming by. Always a blast.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Stay tuned for another exciting James Bond coming your way next year.
Thanks for listening. To hear more We Got the Geek, check us out at www.wegotthegeek.com and on iTunes.